This talk is offered by Ordinary Mind Zendo. Ordinary Mind was founded by Barry Magid, Dharma heir of Charlotte Joko Beck, and is dedicated to her vision of a psychologically minded Zen practice adapted to the needs of American students practicing in the context of their everyday lives. Our public programs are made possible by donations from people like you.
Today is the beginning of Passover, a holiday that commemorates the liberation of the Jews from Pharaoh's Egypt. As such, it is an opportunity for us to think about the whole concept of liberation and the many ways which we think about what that means. On one hand, ever since I began attending seders run by members of my own generation rather than my parents' generation, there was a ongoing effort to identify the liberation celebrated in the center, in the Seder, with civil rights movements and various forms of social liberation that had been going on since the 60s. And in that spirit, seders always seem to include singing Go Down Moses as often as they included Dayenu. And while at the same time in my generation, Buddhism has become increasingly associated with social causes and efforts for peace and civil rights, by and large, the Buddhist version of liberation is directed inward rather than outward. It's a shift in saying, what are we trying to be liberated from? And while we should never forget the importance of being liberated in a political or social sense from various kinds of oppression, the thrust in Buddhist practice was always the notion that we needed to be liberated from something internal to us, not external to us. And this created all sorts of complications. Simply because it imported the very language of liberation from inside, inside our own minds. And so that we get, very typically, the language of political oppression or enslavement applied to the relations of one part of our mind to another. And we not untypically speak of trying to be liberated from the ego, or in parallel traditions, from the superego, or from the self, or from conceptual language. And there is this kind of way in which we, by using this metaphor, seem to establish a relationship between one part of ourselves and another, analogous to that of a king and his subjects, an oppressive king and his subjects, who we might not only want to overthrow, but guillotine. Now, needless to say, this can be become an unhealthy attitude to have towards one part of yourself, thinking it needs to be extirpated in order to for you to find liberation. But it became a very prevalent metaphor, and we often had language of killing the ego and so forth. Now, the dilemma is that the very language of liberation thus colluded with or co-opted by our ongoing sort of unconscious dynamics of self-hate, and that our own divisions, pre-existing divisions in ourselves, in which we hated our own vulnerability, we hated our dependency, we hated our mortality. In a sense, all of these internal splits become recast in the language of spirituality, as if now a spiritual practice would be enlisted in the pursuit of the elimination of a hated part of ourselves by a valorized part of ourselves. And we would call that enlightenment. I think we can't underestimate the ways in which our pre-existing or unexamined ideas of what spiritual practice is going to do or how it works is wrapped up in our psychological agendas of trying to escape some part of ourselves. And the very word spirituality, where spirit comes from a word meaning breath, but spirit became a word in contrast to the body or the material. And so that we were either trying to find a part of the self or soul that was free of the contamination of the body, or thinking of spirituality in terms of another life, again, free of the body. And free of the body usually meant free of sexuality, free of emotion, free of family relations or dependence. And all this is deeply ingrained in Buddhism just as much as in the Judeo-Christian tradition, where the essence of taking the vows is home leaving and the severing of personal and emotional attachments. So the work of our practice now, to a very large extent, involves liberating ourselves from these different versions or fantasies of liberation. That they themselves are the spiritualized counterparts of our own inner conflict. And that we have to find a new kind of way of talking about our suffering, and what we imagine is the cause of our suffering, and what is the path out of that suffering. And it now looks like that path is going to be involving not so much a getting rid of anything, but a redemption or willingness to establish acceptance of all these aspects of ourselves, and particularly our bodily selves, that we came to spiritual practice in order to escape. A very interesting part of the Exodus story that follows the Jews' liberation from Egypt has to do with what happens once they're free. Finally, after years of servitude by way of one divine intervention after another, the Jews are finally able to cross the Red Sea, leave Egypt, and go forward into their own, on their own. They're free. But what happens? They get lost in the Sinai Desert, where they wander and wander for years and years. They don't really know where they're going. They're free, but to do what? You know, all their effort, all their thinking, all their way of talking was about, if only I can get out of Egypt, right? Mm. Well, you finally got out of Egypt. Now what, right? One of the things that happens is that we're told that while Moses goes up Mount Sinai to commune with God and to receive the Ten Commandments, he takes a long time up there. We don't know quite what he's doing or how long it took to climb up and down, but he's gone a long time. And during that time, all these Israelites are at very loose ends, and they decide to gather all their gold jewelry together, melt it down, and build themselves a golden calf as an idol, because they don't want to do without some kind of god or ritual. You know, Moses is off, they don't know if or when he's going to return. And so there's this big vacuum that they fill as best they can. Now, Moses eventually returns with the commandments. But both he and God are rather pissed off to see what's been going on in his absence. In a fit of pique, he smashes the Ten Commandments. I looked up the Bible verse this morning before I came up here. And turns out he got Aaron to get together all of his tribe And they went around and killed 3,000 of their fellows who had been responsible for the calf and purged the population of the idolaters. And then God, just to top it off, sent a plague to further punish them all. Then there's a sort of rerun in which Moses has to go back up the mountain and get a duplicate copy of the Ten Commandments and come down. It's a little complicated, you know. You feel like there are a couple stories woven together here, and the seams are showing. But in any case, what I think is important is that the story of liberation does not end with the Exodus from Egypt. Liberation really only occurs when the Jews accept the Ten Commandments from God. That liberation from is insufficient, right? There has to be a liberation into, and that means a freedom to live a certain kind of structured life. And the Ten Commandments turned out to have over 600 footnotes that were then spelled out in later books of the Old Testament, that all these became the halakha, the laws, the rules of Orthodox religious life. And it was only within the framework of these strict rules that the people were said to finally find freedom. And I think that we can see something very similar in other traditions. And I think particularly if you look at Dogen, freedom in Dogen is very much a precisely rule-given monastic life. The Shobo Genzo, Dogen spells out just about as many rules for living as you know you'd find in an Orthodox Hasidic community. He's got rules for the bathroom and everything else, right? It's in a certain sense, it's meant to be the sacramentalization of every aspect of everyday life. But it is a freedom that is defined by spelling out what it's like to live a good and natural life. And this is very much not a liberation simply from strictures and social norms. Some of you might be watching the recent documentary Wild Wild Country about the Bhagwan Rajneesh and the movement he founded. There they practice the kind of ecstatic liberation from all sorts of conventions, particularly sexual conventions. And there's an interview with him at the beginning, which sounds sort of very, very interesting, where he says, ours is going to be the first spirituality that doesn't deny the body. It's going to be the first spirituality that doesn't split off the spiritual from the material. We're here to enjoy this life. We're here to enjoy material things. Enjoy sex. Enjoy diamonds and Rolls Royces. Enjoy it all, right? This was sort of the idea, right? In a certain sense, it's not bad, you know? I mean, it's not bad to have some alternative to asceticism being the only route to spirituality. And yet the whole thing runs amok, right? It does not end well. Right? And in a certain sense, you know, you can hear the old Hasids and you can hear Dogen say, well, I told you so, you know. if you don't have a structured life, things are just going to fall apart. We see this played out in many, many ways, and it's it was Edmund Burke's conclusion about the French Revolution, exactly the same thing, that you can't have a revolution and cut off the king's head without thinking a little more clearly about what's going to happen next, right? The French got this one good idea, you know, get a guillotine and cut the head off the bad guy. Because they didn't quite figure out what was going to happen next, they just kept repeating that step over and over again. And again, that didn't end well. So if I digress in this way, it's to just to illustrate all the ways, all the permutations of what liberation seems to mean to us. We really need to think about what is it that we think we need freedom from? And then what is it that we think we want freedom for?